And it's a little after the hour. I'm Ben Brown, and it's Tuesday, the 19th of April, and this is a Juno afternoon. The weather, it's mostly cloudy today, isolated rain showers, and partly cloudy this afternoon, but it's actually kind of sunny and nice out. It's going to be clear tonight, mostly cloudy tomorrow, getting a little cloudier as the rest of the week unfolds, but it's not going to be raining sideways the whole time, so there's that to be thankful for. This afternoon, we're going to be hearing from the Early Learning Fair Kindergarten Registration and Business of Caring, the Alaskans Afield series with Kristen Romanoff, Marie Drake Planetarium's presentation, Planet 9 from Outer Space, and an interview with Melvin Adams, who's here as one of the Pillars of Freedom, and also some information on the Tlingit Culture, Language, and Literature program, all here on a Juno afternoon after National Native News. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Finland's Forestry Act took effect Friday, opening the nation's northern forest to harvesting by a state-owned company. That's left the nation's indigenous people, who rely on reindeer herding, scrambling. Tristan Autone reports.
Government officials say the new Forestry Act is an administrative change necessary to be in compliance with European Union trade laws. But for the Sami of northern Finland, there are serious concerns. The new state-owned company will assume responsibility for activities like logging, which would put serious strains on Sami reindeer herding practices. The act also lacks legal protections for the Sami, protections that have been enjoyed in previous versions of the act.
The act is not consistent with the constitutional provision that says that indigenous peoples have the right to maintain and develop their own language and culture, as well as that they have the right to have linguistic and cultural self-government.
That's Victoria Tally Corpus, United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous People.
So the act, which is basically going to deprive them of their control over their grazing lands, is something that will, of course, affect their culture as well as their self-government.
Sami Parliament President Tiina Sanila-Aikio says with the passage of the act, the Sami people will have to remain vigilant to protect Sami reindeer herding practices and resources, and will evaluate legal avenues to prevent the state from logging the region. I'm Tristan Autone.
Staff from Native radio stations across the country are continuing emergency response training this week to be held in Phoenix, Arizona. As KMBA's Jocelyn Estes reports, a recent tribal class was held at a Federal Emergency Management Agency training center.
Roy Dick has worked for 16 years as the morning host and sports producer for Yakima Native Radio in Washington. He's one of almost two dozen broadcasters who attended the first Tribal Nations Training Week at FEMA's Center for Disaster Preparedness in Alabama last month. He says the Yakima have seen bomb scares, severe cold, and snowstorms, so he's urging everyone from first responders and medical care providers to tribal administrators and council members to take FEMA courses.
Then everybody will know how to deal with it and how to get things organized and get things set up to get more involvement of different entities.
Ron Quincy is an emergency medical officer for the Alaska Department of Health and Human Services in Juneau. He oversees training for Alaskan paramedics and emergency medical technicians. He says to make good decisions during emergencies, people need good information.
Radio can take an event and they can concise it. They can also make it worse, but most often they just make sure that the public is informed on what to do.
I'm Jocelyn Estes.
Indigenous people were among those who competed in the Boston Marathon Monday, including those with the U.S. groups Running Strong and Wings of America. For many Native athletes, running is not only a popular sport in their tribal communities, but part of culture. Wendy Lewis is with Munkapi Developers Corporation, an economic development company of Arizona's Hopi tribe. Part of the nonprofit's work promotes tribal cultural awareness of running.
For us, we're dry land farmers on the Hopi Reservation. We rely on rain to get our crop because corn is what we rely on for a lot of our ceremonies.
Lewis says culture is being incorporated in the new clothing line, Strong Ones. The logo pays tribute to the prayer of water. It's two water waves reflecting one another.
We're running and it's raining, we're happy, you know, because we're happy that the rain has come.
The project is teaming up with tribes across the country, including a collaboration on a jacket made this year, which honors the upcoming Rio Olympics. Two Native runners have qualified, Craig Curley and Linnabaugh Snyder. The jacket pays tribute to past Olympians, Louis Tiwanima and Billy Mills, with their images featured on the back. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com. The Albuquerque Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes the Gathering of Nations to the Wise Pies Arena, a.k.a. The Pit, April 29th and 30th. Information on services and the Gathering of Nations at ahcnm.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And it's about 6 minutes after the hour, and today is Tuesday, the 19th of April. I'm Ben Brown. This is a Juno Afternoon. And our first guest today is Nikki Love, who is with the Partnerships for Families and Children and the Association for the Education of Young Children. And she's here to share some information about the upcoming Early Learning Fair. Hello, Nikki. Welcome to a Juno Afternoon.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So tell us what's going on with the Early Learning Fair. It sounds like a lot of fun stuff.
Oh, it's going to be fantastic. It's especially for children ages 3 to 5. So we're really focusing on families whose kids are maybe looking for a preschool option or looking for a different option, or their children are going to kindergarten this fall. So Head Start will be there talking about their programs and enrolling kids. Montessori Borealis will be there, same thing. And then the school district will also be talking about kindergarten registration. That's actually their day of registration, but there will be folks on hand with more information about that. But it's also an opportunity for parents to learn about resources in the community. Our partners from Dolly Parton Imagination Library, from Juno Youth Services, from AWARE, from Parks and Rec, they'll all be on hand letting people know what's available, what activities might be happening currently or maybe during the summer for kids. And the other big piece of it is it's a chance to get your child screened, whether that's vision screenings, hearing screenings. Those are all free. The whole event is free. And just come on down, 4:30 to 6:30. Sign up, come in, make yourself at home, and find out what you can do.
And so it's not like parents who are bringing their young children here have to do all the services. If they're comfortable with the vision and hearing screening, but their child's immunizations may be kind of unknown to them, they could just go straight to the immunization
Absolutely.
Table?
Absolutely. Yeah, okay. There's no requirement at all. I mean, just come and see what's available is really our message. If you want to sign up for something, you can. If you want to get the screenings, you can. There will also be, you know, fun things like some engaging activities for kids and story time with the wonderful folks from the library. And we will also have a guest reader. Mayor Ken Kelsch will be there to read a story with the kids as well. So it's going to be good.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Do you know what the mayor is going to be reading, or is that a surprise?
I think that's a surprise.
All right.
Yep.
You've got to show up to find out what Mayor Kelsch is going to be reading. But it'll be perfect for ages children 3 to 5, I'm sure. And it looks like there's some prizes as well.
Oh, fantastic prizes. There's quite a range from puzzles to bouncy balls, little snake puzzles, things like that. There'll also be some snacks. Lots to do, lots to see. It's also a good opportunity for parents to network with each other. So maybe you're new to the community or new to this whole school thing. So it's nice to reach out to other families and navigate those waters together.
Indeed. And again, there's no pre-registration. It's just a matter of showing up between 4:30 and sometime before 6:30 on Thursday afternoon.
Correct. It's open house. You can come at 4:30, leave whenever you want, or likewise, you know, come later on, and there's an opportunity for everyone.
So if people want to have, if there are any questions that listeners might have ahead of time, how should they reach out and find out to maybe have some of those questions answered before Thursday afternoon?
Sure. They can call AEYC at 789-1235, or they can look on the Juno Partnerships webpage, which is junofamilies.org.
Excellent. And I know that in the past couple of years, some of the kindergarten services that had been provided a little more generously through the state have been cut back with the budgetary pressure. So this may help fill some of the gaps created by that situation.
We are hoping so. Yeah, it's another opportunity for people to understand what the situation is. We're hoping that all the dollars aren't gone, but, you know, it's not looking great. One of the services that is we really, all of us champion, that's the Dolly Parton Imagination Library. it is matched through some best beginnings and state funding that may go away. So we'll really have to, you know, ask the community to step forward to keep that important service available. It's really a cornerstone.
Absolutely. And that's the service whereby young people are receiving books in the home on a regular basis.
Yes. Every month, ages 0 to 5, you can get a book in the home that's developmentally appropriate. And it's a fabulous way to support early literacy and also kindergarten readiness.
Mm-hmm. And then, and of course, the neat thing there is when parents are able to read to their children, and it's a family parent and child activity, it's good for the reading skills, and it's also good just for the interrelationship between the family.
Absolutely. In fact, it might be more important.
Excellent. So this is the Early Learning Fair. It's going to be this Thursday, which is the 21st of April. It's going to be from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. out at the Valley Library. There's ample parking out there.
Yes, there is.
Any other fun facts you want to share with our listeners, Nikki?
I think this is our 9th year doing this. So it's been really popular every year, and we're excited to be doing it again.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you very much, Nikki Love, from Partnerships for Families and Children and the Association for the Education of Young Children. And I hope you have a great turnout on Thursday for the Early Learning Fair.
Thank you, Ben.
All right, thanks. And that, you may recognize, is Aaron Copland's Variations on a Shaker Melody, as performed by Juno's very own symphony orchestra this past weekend. And Jeff Brown was kind enough to cue that up for us to listen to. Here on a Juno afternoon, it's 15 minutes after the hour. Ben Brown here. And my next guest is Kristen Romanoff, who's going to tell us some about the Alaskans Afield series and some other exciting opportunities to get out and about this summer. So welcome to a Juno afternoon, Kristen.
Thank you, Ben. It's nice to be here.
So tell us about Alaskans Afield. How do Alaskans get out in the field?
Well, I think Alaskans do a lot of that on their own, but we also have been offering classes in outdoor skills to women for a number of years through our Becoming an Outdoors Woman program. And I would often hear, well, what about me? I'm a guy wanting to learn these same outdoor skills, or women wanting to expand their skills after going to a BOW program. So we started Alaskans Afield 2 years ago as a way for friends and families to come together and learn new skills or refine ones that they already have. And we change these up depending on the interest of feedback we hear from the community, and then also the volunteer instructors who are really passionate about sharing their expertise. So we just finished one of our Alaskans Afield series with a black bear hunting class, and we're just gearing up for a Becoming an Outdoors Woman weekend out at Echo Ranch in May. And come May 1st, we'll open registration for our summer classes. So Alaskans Afield is all different ages, so we can have, you know, kids coming with their parents or friends coming, or just individuals on their own. And we tend to have, you know, I work with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and partner with our Outdoor Heritage Foundation of Alaska, so we have a lot of fishing and hunting-related skills. But we really also offer the diversity of outdoor skills, because living here, you really have to know a lot when you're out and about. Having basic survival skills, for instance, we offer, you know, just a basic introduction in that way. We have classes queued up for the summer, wild edibles class, a introduction to shotgun, a waterfowl hunting class, a deer hunting class. For women, we're offering the bow weekend in May, and then we'll do classes that we call Beyond Bow. So we'll have a Psyched About Silvers fly fishing on Cowie Creek class. We're going to have an upland game bird hunting class. So a real diversity of offerings, and folks of you know, all ages can sign up.
And so it sounds like it really is very much, much more of a program than just one targeted at women, of course, now. So if a whole family wants to sign up, what are the space limitations and what are the costs, if any? Because you said you had volunteer instructors, but there have to be some costs for making this program happen.
Ben, that's right. And we have volunteers who dedicate so much time, but we do just need to cover the costs of equipment and facility rentals if we need to. For the Alaskans Afield classes, we've kept it so that children attending are free. And so families can come, and it's generally $20 per adult for each of the three-hour skills classes. But, you know, families can come and keep it affordable.
But they can't come and just drop their kids off. The parents have to stay
there.
That's
right. Okay. It's really meant for, you know, families to come together.
Sure, sure. Excellent. So I imagine there must be a website where people can go and learn a little bit more about this, because everything you've described is a lot of information, and people probably can't do them all. So if they wanted to go and read up on, well, if I wanted to do two or three of these things, days this summer, how would they do that?
They would go to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game website, and that's adfg.alaska.gov. And you can, once you're into our website, you can just type in Alaskans Afield in the search, and it'll bring up the whole menu of classes being offered in Juneau. We offer these in other communities around the state, so if you're visiting another place, you could even attend classes elsewhere. Or you can type in BOW if you're a woman wanting to take a similar outdoor skills classes, which are geared, you know, for a women group attending.
And you said, I think, a moment ago, registration isn't open yet, but it's going to open on the 1st of May.
That's right, for our summer classes.
Okay, very soon. So, mm-hmm. But people could still go look at them now and then be ready to register on the 1st.
That's right, and we've just shifted over to a completely online registration process, which really simplifies that. And so we're just closing out our spring classes, and then we're going to shift over into summer registration.
Excellent. And these classes do fill up, don't they?
They do, because we really want that hands-on experience for all the participants and to have, you know, small groups working with instructors. So, you know, some of these classes have a cap at 12 participants. Others go up to 16 to 20, but they do fill up. And we do have a wait list. So if people, you know, still are interested after a class is full, I'll keep them on the wait list. If there's last minute cancellations, people can jump in.
And with the new online registration system, can they pay at the time that they register?
Yes, they can. And that is set up so that it goes to our partner organization, the Outdoor Heritage Foundation, and they pay through that online, and it's a secure payment place online.
Excellent. So Alaskans afield, lots of opportunities here. And this isn't just for beginners. I mean, some of these programs, and again, people should probably go to the website and look at what the curriculum is and what the course offerings are, but there's going to be some things there that are probably valuable even for fairly experienced Alaskans who know their way around.
Oh, absolutely. And we'll, you know, we target, you know, really a lot of beginning level learners, but then we'll also offer, because we have now, this is our third year of offering Alaskans Afield classes, we have returning participants and we want them to continue coming back and refining their skills. So we're offering more advanced classes as well.
The program probably hasn't been around quite long enough to have any of the former students turn into instructors yet, but maybe in the future?
You know, our BOW program, we do have that.
Oh,
we
neat.
Are seeing, because this is our eighth year of the BOW program. And so that's been pretty exciting to see participants instructing.
Well, that's always just a nice natural progression, because it shows that people really did, get bitten by the bug of passion for the outdoors when they were students, and to turn around and be able to provide that back to others is just a great natural sort of holistic rotation.
Exactly. Thanks for mentioning that. Yeah, we're happy to have them continue on as instructors.
So it's as simple as that. Just go to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game website and look this up, or Google the Alaska Outdoor Heritage Foundation. Either way, you're going to get to the list of the opportunities that exist here in the capital city and also other places around Alaska.
That's right. Or they can feel free to call me at 465-8547.
Excellent. All right. Well, Kristen Romanoff, thank you so much for coming in and sharing a little bit of information about Alaskans Afield. Anything else our listeners should know?
No, I just hope everybody enjoys a great season outdoors.
Well, as we were talking about before we went on the air, that's certainly my plan. So I will see you on the trail or at a campground somewhere soon, I hope, everyone.
Sounds good.
Okay,
Ben.
Thanks again, Kristen.
Mm-hmm.
Studios, Melvin Adams and Mandy Massey. Melvin is a former Harlem Globetrotter. He's spoken over 3 million youth. I'll be speaking tomorrow at Pillars of America luncheon at Centennial Hall. Doors open at 11:15 in the morning. Lunch is served at 11:30.
Hey, man, I'm really excited to be here. Excited to be with you. Be excited to be in Juneau. Back, I hadn't been here in like 5 years, and I'm all excited, man, about to get on a helicopter. I'm excited and scared at the same time. So I'm really excited to be here.
Melvin, what would you say is the most important thing your talk center around?
Well, I think it doesn't matter where you come from. What matters is where you're going. Losers always look at what they're going through. Champions always look at where they're going to. to inspire young kids, you know, to dream dreams, that dreams do come true. Most people think I'm 6'8", but when they see me, I'm 5'8" with high heels on. They're kind of shocked, so that, you know. And then also, I think, to men, I think if fathers step into the role what we're created to be, then our families, you know, you'd be more success in our families.
Do you feel like your height has something to do with the number of seals that you've done?
The number of steals. Yeah.
Where do you come from?
Yeah, that's how you do it.
Why basketball?
Basketball, well, I played football. Obviously, my uncle, actually, you're going to have a speaker here called Warren Moon, who played for the Houston Oilers. I know y'all love the Seattle Seahawks, but he played with the Oilers, and my uncle actually played. And so football came real easy for me, being my dad was 6'6", my brothers are 6'8", 6'7", 6'2", my mom was 5'3", and here I am 5'8". Football came real easy for me. Everybody said, you'd make it in that, but you'll never make it in basketball. So I guess I went to what they said I wouldn't because of my mother was a perfectionist and nothing I ever did was good enough. So it was always trying to prove, you know, that workaholism, prove that I can, you know. And I guess whatever you put your mind to, you know, if you work hard, you can make it come a reality.
Your father passed away when you were 13. How did that affect your life?
Oh, it was huge. Well, you know, when my father was alive, I mean, obviously there was a lot of, it was more damaging then because I saw a lot of abuse, both to my mom, to my brothers, as to myself as well, with him not being there. You know, I mean, it was more damaging alive. I think his death really set my mom free, but still leaving a lot of wounds with my mom and with my brothers, even now in their older adulthood and with their children that are seeing the same thing my dad did.
How did that all lead up to the Globetrotters?
Well, that led up to kind of just hard work. Again, I was a mama's boy, so I began to shoot 3,000 jump shots every day, run 3 miles. I drove my mother's car on a major freeway in Houston, Texas at 4 o'clock in the morning and would open up the door and dribble the ball while I was going 5 miles an hour until I could do it going 10. So that allowed me to go to college, be the first one to graduate from college in my family. And athletics is what really opened up the doors and got me around obviously great athletes, but great men who begin to see potential in me that I never could see in other men, that kind of those men motivating me to be what a man should look like.
For people who don't know, can you tell the audience what Harlem Globetrotters were and what they meant, what they continue to do?
Yeah, well, the Globetrotters started in 1927. In the 20s, they wouldn't let blacks play professional sports. So Abe Saperstein, this Jewish guy of Hinckley, Illinois, actually, the Globetrotters was never from Harlem. They were from Chicago. Actually, the owner wanted them to think that they went all around the world when actually they never left Chicago. But his dream was that the Harlem Globetrotters would go all over the world. And so they began to beat teams pretty bad and it became boring. So they started playing with them. And they noticed that the people really loved that. So that kind of intertwined into the Globetrotters. Now they're in their 90th season. So I think over 90 years, it's only been over... Well, you know, there's only been like a few people that have actually went to the moon. There's only over 500 guys that actually had the opportunity in 90 years to wear the red, white, and blue. So for me, being a part of a prestigious organization that travels 320 days a year was one of the greatest memories of my life. Actually being able to meet Curly Neal was really like a highlight. So they're a professional basketball team that travels, that does magical things with the ball, but bring – you never see us on TV bragging about how much money we make, but we promise to make million-dollar smiles every night.
Not everyone can be a Globetrotter. What can they do to achieve success?
Well, you know, whatever you want to be, and whether you're a doctor, lawyer, professional nose digger, whatever your dream is, if you're passionate about it, that's what gets you up when you want to stay in bed. That's what gets you up when you know where you're going, you're making an impact and a change in people's lives. That's what gets you going. If that doesn't get you going, you know, I tell people, follow your passion, because if you do what you love to do, your vocation will become a vacation. You'll want to get up. We had a tornado in Houston. It's just flooding. I didn't get any sleep. And I flew, my flights got all delayed. I was supposed to get in Alaska at 8. I got in at like 12:30. But you know what? I was excited to be able to come to Juneau to inspire and change people's lives. And people like Mandy and all the people that put all this together, people who care about the community and want to see change and give hope, they should be applauded as well. And you, too, for allowing us to be able to come on your show and just kind of share our message and what we're trying to bring to the people here in Juneau.
Who are some of the inspirational figures in your life that our listeners might be familiar with?
Wow, Curly Neal. You know my mom. My wife is an inspiration. You're an inspiration because your voice is motivating people every day as they go to work, as they sit at home. So Mandy Massey, whose hair smells like Pantene, she's awesome.
And you seem to be regular people.
Regular. You know, I think we're on another show, and I think, you know, Whitney Houston was a success in our eyes. She had money, fame. She committed suicide. Robin Williams made us laugh for years, committed suicide, yet they had everything we think we need to be successful in life. But I think we miss out on the simple things in life. The simple things, life is so simple, we make it so hard, and we spend money we don't have to please people we don't like. I've seen many people in what I do who had all the things intangible, but inside was still jacked up. And I think that wherever you are, whether you're a barber, you're the manager at McDonald's, you're a janitor at a store, find joy and passion in what you do, and promotion will come. But it's your attitude that will always determine your altitude. And for me, I wake up every day on purpose with a purpose, because you never know who's listening, who's watching. And to be a part of life change and to be a guy that's a game changer. I applauded myself in that when I was in the game, I wanted to change it, make losers into winners, inspire and motivate. And so,
why did you drop out of the Globetrotters?
Because I met my wife and she looked good. Oh, ooh, she was beautiful. She was so black, she can put fingerprints on her charcoal, you know what I mean? Put yellow lipstick like a cheeseburger, but she was amazing. And so I saw my wife, and that's what I really wanted to do. I wanted to get married and have a family and have some kids so they wouldn't have to go through what I had to go through. So to be a dad, my dad wasn't, and to be not like my mom in some areas, because she did good in some areas, to see my 12-year-old son is seventh grade reading on a ninth grade level doing 10th grade math. Like, I don't know if he's black or Chinese. I think he's blackanese. My 10-year-old just got the highest award in elementary school of 1,200 students, the Character Award. And he got it in fourth grade, and he got it last year in third. So to be able to leave a legacy with my children so that they can see a dad, you know, love their mom, and what does it all look like? What is it all about? And just finding out what they don't have to play basketball. They don't have to be like what I did. But whatever they do, you know, be passionate about it and love it.
I'm talking with Melvin Adams, former Harlan Globetrotter, now inspirational speaker. Speaking tomorrow at the Centennial Hall, Mandy Massey, do you want to give us information about this show?
Sure. Yes, it's not too late to get your tickets. You can get those at Hearthside Books, either downtown or in the Valley. And tickets are $35. You'll want to get to Centennial Hall early. Doors open at 11:15, and lunch is served. It's a wonderful sit-down lunch catered by the Hangar on the Wharf. It's a great time. Grab your coworker, a student you know, your son, daughter, sister, friend. It's worth coming out for this amazing, inspirational event.
And what are the speakers do we have in the next few weeks?
We have, after Melvin, we have two more weeks, Tiana Tozer and Warren Moon, each consecutive Wednesdays.
And where can people get more information?
You can do a couple of things. You can go online to find us at JunoGlacierValleyRotary.com or go ahead and contact a Rotarian from Glacier Valley Rotary Club.
Mandy Massey and Melvin Adams, thank you so much for being on the show. Is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
I just want to let everybody know, listen, that you're loved, you know what I mean, and enjoy today, smile, because you never know whose life you could change.
Program support provided by Kindred Post, a full-service post office, gift shop, and community gathering space located downtown at 145 South Franklin Street and open 10 a.m. until 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday. More information at kindredpost.com or on Instagram at kindred_post.
And prior to that spot for Kindred Post, we were hearing from Melvin Adams, who, as Jeff Brown correctly noted, will be speaking tomorrow at the Pillars of Freedom series. Jeff recorded that interview earlier today, and I want to thank him for doing so because I wasn't able to do that. And it would have been awkward to do it over the phone. So it's about 34 and a half minutes after the hour, and our next guest this Tuesday, the 19th of April, on a Juneau afternoon, is Rosemary Walling, an adjunct professor at the University of Alaska Southeast, who teaches astronomy. And she's going to talk to us about a show that's coming up at Marie Drank Planetarium. So, Rosemary, welcome to a Juneau afternoon.
Thank you, Ben.
And what is going to be happening tonight in outer space?
So, first of all, we'll start the show at 6:30. At the Marie Drake Planetarium, and Clark Branch will show everybody the stars tonight. And then I'll give a short talk about Planet 9, Planet 9 from outer space.
All right, not to be confused with Love Potion number 9.
No, and not to be confused with Pluto either.
The ninth planet.
Who used to be the ninth planet.
Okay, well, so yeah, go ahead and unpack some of that mysterious, don't give it all away, but just a little bit more of a hint of what people might learn if they're able to come to the planetarium this evening.
Well, nobody has actually seen Planet 9 yet. What they've seen is some very strange orbits in the most distant objects that we've actually seen in our solar system. So these are some objects that are way beyond the orbit of even Pluto. And they're very elongated. We call that like an ellipse,
mm-hmm.
Very stretched out. And they have a very strange orientation, so it's like a cluster, but not a cluster in location, but a cluster in shape. And so when I think of what it looks like, to me, it looks kind of like butterfly wings. So the butterfly itself, the body, is like the plane of the solar system. And then there's these orbits that are going off at two angles. And it's a little bit more complicated than that, but in order to explain those orbits, people have come up with different proposals for some type of extra mass. Some additional objects that are even further out. And the Planet 9 idea is one that there's just one object that's causing these very strange objects to have their own orbits, and it's about 10 times the mass of our Earth. And it's if you think of the solar system in terms of the distance from the Earth to the Sun, this is like several hundred of those units further away from the Sun than we are. And so, like I said, nobody's really seen it right now. It's indirect evidence where you look at how gravity must be affecting other things and you reason that there's this object. And so then doing a computer simulation, it appears to bear out.
And so if it's having, if Planet 9 is having an effect on other things that are orbiting in an elliptical butterfly wing pattern, is it having an effect on the known planets of our solar system, or are we not sure?
It doesn't appear to be. These objects are so far out that they're sometimes called detached objects. They don't really interact with the big planets like Jupiter through Neptune. And so Planet 9 is kind of the big guy on the block in that part of the neighborhood. And so it's thought that in the past we know that the outer planets were born in places where they're not now and that they've migrated over time. And some of that's been kind of smooth and some of it's been really cataclysmic. And it's thought that Planet 9 might have been something like Uranus or Neptune that got kicked out by Jupiter. And then it just caused havoc, you know, where it is.
Interesting. Definitely very, very interesting. And so if people want to come to learn more about this tonight, when do they need to get there? How long will it go on? Is there any cost? It sounds like it's pretty intense, so I'm going to guess little kids might not totally grasp it all, but I don't know. So describe who's going to be the ideal audience for you
tonight.
Well,
it's usually a mix. And so we'll do the stars at first. And I've tried to have some very simple pictures. So if the kids stay for the talk, I don't think they'll be totally bored. And I just think it's for everybody. And sometimes people decide to leave after the stars, you know, if the kids are real little or if they're kind of restless. But I think I'm going to try to make it for everybody.
Excellent. And is there any charge?
No, there's no charge, and it's at 6:30 at the Marie Drake Planetarium.
Okay. Well, that sounds quite interesting. And I have to say, you know, I try to stay abreast of these things. You know, I read The Economist, and every now and then there's a scientific article in there. But this is the first I've heard about Planet Nine, so it snuck up on me.
Yes, January 2016.
Okay, so then I shouldn't feel too bad.
Right.
Right. So is there any chance it's having any effect on the presidential election? Could we chalk anything up to that?
Well, you can in a way, because the two largest of these objects that have the weird shape, one is Sedna, which people may have heard about, and the other one has a designation that has to do with when it was found, 2013, VP-112, something like that. And because it's called VP, it's nicknamed Biden. So maybe it does have an effect on the elections.
All right. Well, I was just wondering. I mean, it seems like there's large things circling around out there in the cosmos, and you never know what effect that's having down here on Earth.
Right.
Well, good. So that's Planet Nine, and this is Rosemary Walling, and she'll be speaking tonight beginning at 6:30 at the Marie Drake Planetarium. And it's open to all comers, and young people would enjoy seeing the stars up in the planetarium
right.
dome. And then if they didn't want to stay for the talk, you would have a chance for them to maybe take
right.
a little break.
And it's free. We are happy to take donations, but it is free.
Excellent. Any other information you'd like to impart to our listeners this afternoon, Rosemary?
I think that's about it.
Excellent. All right. Well, then, folks, now is a good night to go and learn more about Planet Nine so you won't be ignorant like I was. And, you know, at some cocktail party or dinner party in the next few weeks, you can dazzle people with your knowledge of this relatively new phenomenon in astronomy that there's a chance to learn about tonight. So thank you very much, Rosemary Walling. And listeners, go to Marie Drake Planetarium tonight at 6:30 to learn more.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And here is the writer's almanac for Tuesday. It's the 19th of April, 2016. It's the anniversary of the beginning of the American Revolution at the battles of Lexington and Concord fought on this date in 1775. 700 British soldiers had marched out from Boston to seize the colonials' military supplies and to try to capture John Hancock and Samuel Adams, who were in hiding. This was the march that Paul Revere was waiting in Boston to signal which way the British would come, as Longfellow wrote in his famous poem, "One if by land, and two if by sea, and I on the opposite shore will be, ready to ride and spread the alarm through every Middlesex village and farm, for the country folk to be up and to arm." The British regulars arrived in Lexington at about 5 in the morning. They found 77 colonial militiamen waiting for them. Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote his Concord hymn about it. "By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled. Here once the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world." Nonetheless, the American militia lost that brief battle, but in Concord there was a larger force of colonials waiting, and though the British did destroy the arsenal, they were forced back to Boston under heavy rifle fire, and by the end of the day, the Revolutionary War had begun. It was on this day, 1824, the poet Lord Byron died while fighting with the Greeks in their war of independence from Turkey. He died of disease, not from warfare, but nonetheless Greece proclaimed him a national hero. And to this day, Byron is still a popular name for boys in Greece. It's the birthday of the diarist Sarah Kemble Knight, born in Boston, 1666, who in 1704, she took a journey on horseback from Boston to New Haven and kept a very precise journal of her travels, which remains now one of the best documents and chronicles of how people lived back in the 18th century. And it's the birthday of John Agee, born in Nyack, New York, 1960, author of books for children and also a book of palindromes, phrases that read the same forward and backward. The title of the book was "Go Hang a Salami, I'm a Lasagna Hog." It came out in 1991. Here's a poem for today by Mary Oliver, entitled I Have Just Said. I have just said something ridiculous to you, and in response, your glorious laughter. These are the days the sun is swimming back to the east, and the light on the water gleams, as never, it seems, before. I can't remember every spring, I can't remember everything, so many years. Are the morning kisses the sweetest, or the evenings, or the in-betweens? All I know is that thank you should appear somewhere. So, just in case I can't find the perfect place, thank you, thank you. A poem by Mary Oliver, I Have Just Said, from Felicity, published by Penguin, and used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac. Supported by LegalZoom, providing legal help to Americans with online services, customer support, and independent legal advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. And by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
They were building a school in the Lemon Creek Valley. It was kind of a middle school, not too far from the jail or the landfill. And they thought long and hard about what they might call it. There were many suggestions, proposals, proponents, opponents, but only one of them was chosen, and some hard words were spoken, not the least of which was Suntikahini. They called it Suntikahini. Suntikahini. They called it Suntikahini. Now Zunti is the flounder, and Heen is fresh water, a stream or a river. The K apostrophe in the middle is diminutive, and the I at the end is possessive, the little water of the flounder. Suntikahini, they called it Suntikahini. Suntikahini, they called it Suntikahini. But it seems that our culture is disrespectful of flounders, because lately to flounder means to flip-flop, stumble, and blunder. But if I were to Zunti, I wonder just what would that be? Yes, if I were to Zunti all over the floor, would you still love me? Would you call out for more? Zunti, 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 Suntikahini. They called it Suntikahini. Suntikahini, Suntikahini.
And John Palm singing Suntikahini, a pretty self-explanatory song and a perfect introduction to our next guest here on a Juno afternoon. It's about 11 minutes before the hour. I'm Ben Brown. Today is Tuesday, the 19th of April. And Brandy Scott from the Juno School District is here specifically to talk about the Tlingit Culture, Language, and Literacy Program. So, Brandy, welcome to a Juno afternoon.
Thanks, Ben.
And what is going on with the Tlingit Culture, Language, and Literacy Program right now?
Well, we're gearing up for another year of school and already looking towards next year. We are really excited about getting new families into our program, especially kindergarten families who are registering and joining the school district for the first time.
All right. And so I guess I was not aware. I knew that there was some Tlingit immersion education going on, but this sounds like it starts at the very youngest ages of formal education.
It does. We are a free optional program, and we're open to students in the school district of all races, nationalities, and abilities. And we have three multi-age classrooms that span kindergarten through fifth grade, where students just gain knowledge and confidence in their cultural identity.
And how long has this program been going on?
The program was founded about 15 years ago by Catherine Kitty Eddy and her sister Nancy Douglas. They started the first classroom, which was just K-1, and built it up and nurtured it from there. And Kitty actually retired at the end of the school year last year. So we have a great staff carrying on in her tradition, for sure, with Josh Jackson teaching kindergarten and first grade combined, Rocky Eddy teaching second and third grade combined, Shken George is the fourth and fifth grade teacher. We also have a Tlingit language instructor. Her name's Jessica Chester, and I am the reading specialist for the program, Brandy Scott. We also invite Selena Everson in as a fluent speaker and elder. The students and teachers are regularly addressed by David Kapsik as well as a fluent speaker.
And how much time would a student spend over the course of a week if he or she were to enroll in the program?
Every Monday morning, we kick off our day and start our week by gathering in the gym and practicing and celebrating as our very own K-5 dance group. So the students are engaged in singing and dancing in the traditional style every week, sometimes multiple times a week. But we are focused on that for the first 45 minutes of the day on Monday mornings. And then every day, Monday through Friday, Jessica Chester visits each classroom and does interactive Tlingit language lessons for at least 30 minutes a day with Selena Everson and her language apprentice Mallory Story as her assistants. So it's really carried and woven in throughout the day, but the immersive piece is that 30-minute language lesson every day in each classroom.
That's a fair amount of instruction. That's not insignificant. Now, if the program is going on for 15 years, I imagine some of the alumni from the first year are getting to the point where they're about to be in high school or graduate from high school, depending on when they started. And have there been some kind of fun success stories there, people going on to UAS or other places where they're going to continue their Tlingit learning?
Kitty has shared with me just last year some of the great success stories she saw as the founder of the program, and I believe that the students from those first few years were some of our most successful students, and a large number of them kind of fought off the stereotype and were very successful as Native students, and they graduated from high school and definitely went against the graduation rates that were pervasive at the time, and many enrolled into college. And she kind of tracked them and followed them through along.
Excellent. And I imagine they're probably pretty good advocates for Alaska Native language education generally. The legislature impaneled a task force a couple of years ago to kind of look at this specific problem. And this just sounds like the sort of success story that task force is going to want to see replicated in communities across the state.
We absolutely, as the TCLL staff, have that mission to take a language that is in danger of dying with less than 100 fluent speakers and really ignite a passion in our students for learning the language, for carrying it on, for knowing their cultural identities, and for sharing that with their families and as many people as they can.
Absolutely. Now, our first guest today was Nikki Love talking about the early learning fair. I don't know if you're going to be participating in that event on Thursday, or if not, what's the best way for a listener who's interested in getting a young person involved in learning Tlingit to get in touch with you?
Well, we are calling out to all families who have 5- and 6-year-olds to definitely look into kindergarten registration. The first day is Friday the 22nd from 1:30 to 5, and we ask that you just go to your neighborhood school and have your kindergartner registered for school in the Juneau School District. If you are interested in the TCLL program, we wholeheartedly invite you to Harborview to come see what we're about, to register at Harborview, and to just ask for an optional programs packet and an application, and to just select TCLL as an optional program for your kindergartner next year.
So it's just a natural part of getting registered for kindergarten. You know, I'm sure when I was a kid, there was no kindergarten registration. I think our parents just dropped us off, but that was back in the 70s, and it was a whole different world back then. And there certainly wasn't any. Clinton, I was in Anchorage, but there was no Dena'ina immersion program at College Gate Elementary School. I can tell you that either. So very lucky that we have this resource here in Alaska's capital city. So Brandy Scott, again, with the Tlingit Culture, Language, and Literacy Program, any other information you'd like to impart to our listeners this afternoon?
We would just love to see new families come out, kindergarten or any other grade. We're always looking to add to our flock. We're very much a family. There's very much a family feel to our program, with students continuing from K through 5th with the same small group of teachers and group of students. So we'd just love for you to come give us a try and join our family and help learn new things.
Excellent. All right. Well, I want to thank you very much, Brandy Scott. I should say gunal sheesh for being here this afternoon. And listeners, don't delay when you're registering youngsters for kindergarten. Get them registered in Tlingit Culture, Language, and Literacy. And if they're a little bit older, they can still join in one of those other multi-year classrooms. So thanks again, Brandy.
Thanks, Ben.
This is Bird Note. It's spring. And for many birds, a time to look their best to attract a new mate. This American goldfinch has recently molted. Its old worn-down feathers have fallen out, and new ones have grown in. The male is now a vivid yellow with a striking black back and wings. When goldfinches molt in the fall, they lose these brightly colored feathers. That way, they may hang around all winter unnoticed. Their winter camouflage helps them blend in with the drab background of the season. In spring, they molt again, making a dramatic change into their stunning breeding plumage. And the goldfinch isn't the only bird to make this surprising transition. The willow ptarmigan, a bird of the northern latitudes, is rusty brown in summer, blending in with the tundra where it nests. In the fall, its plumage changes to a winter white, matching the landscape. Some gulls, like these laughing gulls, and also the Bonaparte's gull, add dapper black or brown hoods for the breeding season. And many male ducks turn into downright dandies to attract a mate. Summer, fall, winter, or spring, we're glad you listen to Bird Note.
You pin a silver star to your chest and you give evil men something to draw down on. Think long and hard before you pick up that badge. The true story of the Birch Brothers, the final western of the last frontier. Monday night, the 25th of April at 7 p.m. on KTOO.
Mondays are back at the Diamond Park Aquatic Center. Now open Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m., Saturdays 9 a.m. until 6 p.m., and Sundays noon until 6 p.m. Schedules are available online at juneau.org/parkrec/diamondpark. For more information, call Diamond Park Aquatic Center at 586-2782.
And you've been listening to a Juneau Afternoon. It's just about a minute before the hour. I'm Ben Brown. Thanks so much for listening. It's sunny outside right now, and it's going to be cloudy or partly cloudy for the rest of the week. So take advantage of the lovely spring weather. Thanks again for listening to a Juneau Afternoon.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay,
K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Obama's farewell visit, they're already looking ahead to the next administration and hoping, as they see it, for a better partner.
They are the Saudis, and U.S.-Saudi relations are as complicated as ever.
It's Tuesday, April 19th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Kelly McEver. Some Americans say links between Saudi Arabia and 9/11 have never been fully exposed.
They want 28 classified pages of a congressional report released.
Those 28 pages are critical to the understanding of how our foreign policy should be shaped.
Donald Trump appears poised to win a lot of delegates in the Northeast.
Republican leaders are poised for a convention like none other.
This is about picking somebody that can win in November and can govern.
Former RNC Chair Haley Barbour.
First, this roundup of the news. Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Polls are open for another hour in the state of New York, which is holding crucial presidential nominating contests for Republicans and Democrats today. NPR's Tamara Keith is following Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton's campaign.
Hillary Clinton voted this morning in her adopted hometown of Chappaqua, New York.
I am so excited about both campaigning here in New York, voting here in New York, and I love New York.
Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders greeted New Yorkers on the street, including a man who said he wouldn't be able to vote because he had trouble changing his registration to the Democratic Party. Sanders raised concerns about the state's closed primary system.
Today, 3 million people in the state of New York who are independent have lost their right to vote in the Democratic or Republican primary. That's all.
Sanders is spending the rest of his day campaigning in Pennsylvania, which votes next week. Tamara Keith, NPR News, New York.
Ecuador's president says it will take years to recover and rebuild after Saturday's earthquake, which left over 440 people dead and at least 4,000 injured. NPR's Scott Horsley reports President Obama telephoned his South American counterpart today, offering condolences and a pledge of assistance.
President Obama told Ecuador and President Rafael Correa the U.S. will do all it can to support the victims of Saturday's quake, as well as the fragile Ecuadorian economy. Low oil prices had already put a squeeze on Ecuador's growth before the quake. Correa estimated the damage at up to $3 billion and warned recovery would be a long struggle. Some 1,500 buildings were damaged or destroyed, leaving more than 20,000 people in search of shelter. USAID has dispatched a team of disaster experts to respond to Ecuador's humanitarian needs. In the phone call with Obama, Correa thanked the American people for their help during this difficult time. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
The Senate has signed off on a new measure aimed at bolstering security at the nation's airports. On a 95-3 vote, senators approving a measure that would provide new protections for airline passengers and also extend the powers of the Federal Aviation Administration through October of next year. During debate before today's vote, Florida Democratic Senator Bill Nelson said it moves ahead in some key areas.
It contains some of the most significant passenger-friendly reforms and airport security enhancements that we've seen in years.
The measure looks at aviation safety, security, and consumer issues. The House remains bogged down in dispute over whether to privatize air traffic control operations and has yet to act. Chipmaker Intel has announced further job cuts at the company, citing a slowdown in the sales of personal computers. The company says it lacks around 12,000 jobs. That's roughly 11% of its current worldwide workforce. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 49 points. This is NPR.
My name is Elizabeth Jenkins. I'm a reporter at KTOO, and I've been in public media for about 3 years. My favorite story I think I've done was online cemetery mapping to ensure Juno always knows where the bodies are buried. The reason that one's my favorite is because it has a great combination of character and sound and story. You know, Evergreen's a historic cemetery in Juno, and no one knows who's buried where. And there's a lot of really important people buried there, too, like Joe Juno and Elizabeth Paratrovich. I met this man. His name is Ben Patterson, and he's the groundskeeper there. Probably my favorite part of that, about that story is he shows me this, like, grease-smudged stack of papers. And that's the only record of where people are buried there. Who would have thought?
Basically 25 pages of maps that show all the plots.
And then he takes me out onto the cemetery grounds, and he can memorize that stack. He shows me where people are buried, and he loves his job. He has such a pride for what he does and respect for where he works.
Was just mowing the other day, and someone walked up and asked me where a certain person was, and I just happened to have just weed whipped around his headstone, and I was able to walk right over and show them right where it was, and they were joking with me that I had all 8,000 graves memorized.
Then the other part of that story, kind of getting into the sound richness of it, is you have a GPS mapper who comes in, and he has this tool, and you can hear it beeping.
And Joseph Juno's been mapped.
Outside, city cartographer Quinn Tracy holds a GPS device above the headstone. I think that's what's so great about public radio is you really feel like you're moving along with these people in the story.
Great story from Elizabeth, and just one little insight, one little window into all of the great work, the great stories, the great content that the reporters here at KTOO produce on a daily basis. My name is Justin. I am the development director here at KTOO. I'm in the studio with Annie and Jamie, and we are here talking
good
to
afternoon.
You.
Good afternoon. Yes.
Yeah. And welcome.
It is gorgeous outside, and that is my favorite spot from Elizabeth. I feel like it represents perfectly what KTOO's local news team do. It's thoughtful reporting, it's sound rich, and I love the production on it. Scott Burton did that.
Yeah, and I love the way she talked about moving through the story with the people in the story. I mean, that is one of the things that radio brings that other forms of news really don't, I would say, whether it's print media or even television. I feel in a way radio, you're using your imagination. You're really engaging in the story in that unique way that doesn't happen anywhere else except here on K2.
Yeah, I agree with that. And one of the things, you know, one of the reasons why that particular piece stands out to me, too, is because she does really talk about the craft of storytelling, which is such a part of the art and part of what you get from all of the great journalists here at KTOO is so much more than, you know, just opening up your web browser and reading the news. You get these great, really well-crafted, rich stories like the one Elizabeth has referenced and so many others. One of them comes to mind right now that Lisa Fu had done a couple years ago, and it was this terrific, terrific piece about a couple of guys who were going around. I wish I could remember their names. I can't at the moment, but going around and collecting all of this audio from Glacier Bay and places around.
Oh, yeah. It's Hank Lenfer and Richard Nelson, I think, are their names. Yeah. Yeah, great story. Yeah.
It was a terrific piece. And I accessed that on K2.org so many times just to hear that wolf. That owl.
It's late at night in the dark, kind of like when you're getting geared up for something. That's how before you go out on the town.
Jonesing for that wolf noise.
We all do it.
Every Friday night.
It's true, yeah.
If you've ever accessed KTOO News on our website, which is so easy to navigate, and can I say beautiful, that's worth something.
It is. It is worth a gift of $5, $10, $15 a month, whatever you can afford. It is what makes all of these great stories possible. It's what makes that beautiful website that you just mentioned, ktoo.org, where you can access all of these stories anytime you want, including any archive story you want to find. That's all possible because of your support.
Yeah, and it's such a huge part of all of our lives here. I mean, the news, the music, excellent radio, everything else. I think about all the time. I'm a sustaining member as well, a few bucks a month. And, you know, if you call 586-3636 right now, you could also become a sustaining member, by the way, or KTOO.org. I don't know if we've thrown the phone number out yet. But I think about what I pay for other stuff and how much more I get out of this radio, these radio stations, out of this building, than honestly I do out of the Netflix discs been sitting on my counter for 8 months that I haven't sent back yet. Yeah. Or other great services that I pay for, too. I mean, this is really – the bang for your buck here is really impressive out of KTOO.
586-3636. Call the number, make a donation, and make this beautiful day even better.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Kelly McEvers in Culver City, California.
And I'm Robert Siegel in Washington. Here's the backdrop for President Obama's visit to Saudi Arabia tomorrow. U.S.-Saudi relations are as rocky as they've been in years. At the same time, they're about as unbreakable as ever. It's a relationship that is long and complicated and getting more so. The president will be meeting with Saudi King Salman and will stay to meet other leaders from Arab Gulf countries on Thursday. NPR's Deborah Amos covers Saudi Arabia and is on the line now to talk about what the two countries seek from each other. And Deb, before we get to what the friction is about, tell us what the U.S., what President Obama would be working on with the Saudis.
Well, you know, despite those frictions, the U.S. and the Saudi leadership still think that they need each other on a strategy to fight the Islamic State, on a way to end two brutal wars in the region, Syria and Yemen. And the Saudis depend on U.S. arms sales to ensure their security. And the kingdom is still a major oil supplier to the U.S. It's about 1 million barrels a day. But there's no doubt that